This is Eric Detweiler, and I'm here with Andrew Uzendowski.
Hello.
And we're here to present Eating, the final full episode of the first season of the Zoogma podcast.
In 2009, the average Austin, Texas resident spent over $6,000 on eating out at restaurants. That was nearly twice the national average, and it was the highest city average in the United States.
In this episode, we're bringing you three perspectives on the rhetorical aspects of food and eating. We've got a University of Texas instructor who taught a course on the rhetoric of food, got a food podcaster, and finally a head chef.
This podcast aims to highlight the unique aspects of Austin's food scene, one that is characterized by words on the page, the screen, in university classrooms, and through podcasts, as much as the very trailers and restaurants that serve the food. Ultimately, we hope these three interviews inspire you to explore the Austin food scene, or whatever food scene you call home. Enjoy, and thanks for listening. Hello, I am joined here by Colleen Isles. And what do you do here at University of Texas?
I am in the graduate program for the Department of English. I just finished my fifth year. And as part of that, I've taught in the rhetoric department, and I currently teach in the English department.
We're here to talk about specifically your rhetoric of food class. Can you please give us a quick overview of the syllabus of the rhetoric of food? What did you read and what did you study?
The rhetoric of food class, I taught for two semesters, and in both cases, the general structure stayed the same. We read popular texts, articles in the Austin Chronicle, articles in national publications, advertisements on TV, on radio, on the internet. We read packages of food. And we clustered our readings of those texts around, for the first half of the semester, gender and sexuality, and then for the second half of the semester, around race, ethnicity, culture, and issues of authenticity and what that meant.
Now, a general question, just before we get into the nuts and bolts of this interview. What is the rhetoric of food? What does it mean in your class? Is it what the food says, how it talks?
For us, it was the discourse about food, the way that food is presented, both in terms of who prepares it, how that's represented, who eats it, how we eat it, under what conditions we eat it. So, for instance, what is acceptable for men to eat? What is acceptable for women to eat? How can women talk about food? So one of the examples that we talked about a lot in class were the new Dr. Pepper 10, the 10 manliest calories a man can drink, and the marketing of low-calorie sodas for men specifically, and how that has to be gendered in a very masculine way. Whereas diet sodas are generally marketed toward women. And so, for instance, we would just look at, like, so what is the discourse? What is the rhetoric surrounding the food? How are they appealing to their audiences? And why are those appeals different? But for us, it wasn't necessarily what the food was saying as much as what the advertisements were, what the conversations were around food and around the bodies that make the food and around the bodies that consume the food. Fat shaming was another issue.
Which mediums of advertisement did you look at? I mean, did you look at television, internet, songs, commercials? What were you particularly looking at as your texts to understand this rhetoric of food?
I opened it up to just about anything the students wanted to bring in, but by and large, TV advertisements and print ads were the two most popular. They really loved the visual rhetoric of it, and there's usually print to go along with it or whatever the slogan is. Slogans are great for that. So we focused on those. A third category that was really productive were the websites for restaurants. And so how do they market it? Like, what atmosphere are they trying to create? Ethos was a big thing there.
Can you give an example of an advertisement for food that on first glance your students just saw an advertisement for food, but then in classroom after close analysis could see the gender or racial or class kind of coding within it? Can you think of a good example where, you know, you have an advertisement that looks on the surface to be about burgers or something, but underneath is about a lot more?
I can think of a couple. The first one that comes to mind are the Snickers advertisements, where it's like, don't be a diva or don't be whatever they call Betty White for that, which my students, when I would play it for them, by and large, just thought they were hilarious. And then we would stop and, you know, look at the gender, like what was going on in terms of gender, in terms of age, in terms of race. And there's also a Burger King ad, which I would actually have to look up to get specifically. It was aired, or it was published in Europe primarily. I think it might have been published in the U.S., but I'm not sure, where they have the figure of a tall white cowboy and a shorter luchador. These images were being used to sell Burger King's new burger, which had jalapenos on it, and chipotle sauce. And so the series of advertisements were those two characters getting along, or those two characters helping each other out with the idea of, like, these two flavors combined to make something even better. However, in almost all cases, there's a clear power differential, right? The cowboy is the one holding the luchador up. The cowboy is actually providing more help to the luchador, who is feminized in these cases. And by and large, my students didn't see any problem with it when I put the ads up. Most of them laughed, and then we used that laughter as an opportunity to talk about what was funny. And by getting to what was funny, we talked about, I mean, that allowed us to really explore what's problematic, both in racial terms and nationalist terms, but then also in gender terms, right? So why is it funny to feminize a man, particularly when talking about food and food discourses?
What did you learn in the class that you didn't know? What did your students teach you that coming into the class you weren't necessarily aware of or, you know, didn't really think of?
I found that I was completely out of touch with, I mean, on a very basic level, I was completely out of touch with fast food. Kim Kardashian sells hamburgers. Like, why does that even make sense? Like, I mean, there are a lot of just like small things. What I gained most out of the class was the opportunity to explain to students very thoroughly and using popular texts, like dynamics of racial interactions or the dynamics of gender interactions. I learned a lot about popular culture in the class, quite honestly. I learned about dubstep. One of my students wanted to talk about the music that was in different restaurants, both the pacing of it, the lyrics, and how that was creating an ethos within different restaurants. And so he introduced me to a lot of music. I had no idea that dubstep existed, let alone what it sounded like. Similarly, I wasn't aware of a lot of hipster eating habits. And so I had some hipster students introduce me to some very obscure foods. And they were very upset to find out that those foods or the companies that sell those foods follow very mainstream advertising techniques. They fall into the same traps of gender and racial representations that the mainstream, that Burger King does.
And what specific kinds of foods do you see the most kind of, not only cultural representation, but actual like teaching the consumers about something, about culture, about gender?
Dessert is a big one. Dessert and other treats, because for women, it's treated as an indulgence. Like, we'll just give in, or it's considered sinful, but in a playful way in the advertisements. But that playful sinfulness actually does translate to sort of sinfulness. And so what you'll see in a lot of chocolate ads or ice cream ads are women underneath a sign saying, like, indulge yourself. They'll be taking one small bite, or they won't actually be eating in the ad. They'll just kind of have it, like, poised at the edge of their lips. Whereas when these ads are targeting men, I mean, the men are actually diving in, right? And I think that that's much more of a real I don't know if it's a much more of a real representation, but indulge yourself to me isn't eat half of that tiny Snickers bar or half of that tiny Dove chocolate, which would be a better example. If you're going to indulge yourself, you can eat the whole bag. I don't care whether they're mini bites or not. My students and I would talk about that, and that was their reaction too. And we would talk about the effect that this actually has and how it teaches us to think about food and what those real life lessons are. And I would have them just look, like, wherever they ate. First of all, to pay attention to who they were eating with, what they were eating, what time of day they were eating, where they sat. And I'd have them look around them to see who was eating. And they picked up on a lot of patterns that sociologists have talked about for a long time. Women are less likely to eat by themselves. They'll skip a meal, or they'll eat alone, like not in a public space. Men don't really have a problem with that. for women, a lot of times there's social pressures for like what you eat, how you eat, whether you stuff yourself, whether you're embarrassed to eat on a date or not. And a lot of this comes back to that sort of sinfulness, or that it's actually wrong for women to eat, or it's wrong for women to desire. And that, as scholars have noted, desiring food has been equated or attached to sexual desires for so long that, I mean, again, it brings it back to sinfulness, but it's also that women should be controlled and women should be poised. And what's astounding to me is that we've noticed those patterns for hundreds of years, and nothing's really changed in the advertisements today in terms of like how you still never see a woman portrayed in a good light eating an entire burger. You'll see her like licking the sauce off, which really is just a performance for men, right? Because it's that's why you have Kim Kardashian selling a hamburger. But.
Did you find your students wanted a change, that they would have appreciated if, you know, the gender norms are switched and you had women enjoying giant burgers and you had men, you know, indulging in their sweet tooth?
Several of them actually for the final projects reimagined ad campaigns that were more progressive. And we talked a little bit about whether it would actually be progressive to switch the genders or to, you know, break down those barriers. But as one class exercise, I had them in groups switch the genders, right? So like, what would it look like? I mean, the whole class, I'm sure I didn't get to listen to the best parts of the conversation, which I'm sure they wouldn't tell their instructor. But everybody was laughing because, I mean, the thought of a man delicately, you know, sipping a tiny little bit of Diet Coke or something is funny, the same way a woman actually scarfing down several burgers but still being represented as desirable is funny. I mean, because we just don't see that. But a lot of them, yes, by the end of the semester, were very indignant. They would report to me. I would get emails. They'd come into class, and they were very indignant that this was happening. And I think we have some budding feminists among the class, and more racial awareness, too. A lot of the Mexican food scene in town.
Yeah. What was the discourse that you guys talked about the Mexican food scene in Austin?
But when we talked about the way certain places are portrayed as authentic or not authentic, and we sort of exploded that term and got to what that meant. We had, I taught Coco Fusco, who talks about cultural appropriation, and we talked about the ways in which certain restaurants will culturally appropriate Mexicanness, right? And so certain signifiers come to stand in. So if you have guacamole on the menu, then it's, you know, it's Mexican. If you put cumin on something, it's Mexican. We found that in many cases, what Coco Fusco was saying in 1992 or in the early 90s was very true today about how people will consume representations of Mexicanness and still not engage with the Mexican Americans around them, right? Still hold, you know, their racial politics separate from their food choices.
Do you have a favorite bad commercial about food?
I'll say the Dr. Pepper 10 commercial, where at the beginning it instructs women to go into the other room. And then it tries to be as masculine as possible, like inject as much testosterone as possible into the advertisement. And so there's, of course, like men on some sort of motor. I don't remember if there's a four-wheeler or a motorcycle, but they're shooting like laser balls. And it's narrating what it's doing the whole time. So it's very like aware of its own sort of ridiculousness. But I think that that's an interesting one because, first of all, the whole point is to masculinize a low-calorie soda, which is something that, you know, not that I'm in favor of low-calorie sodas, but weight is an issue for men as well as for women, even though that opens up a whole can of worms. But what I think is interesting is that it can be read in several different ways. I had students who read it very straightforwardly, of like, yes, that is a manly commercial. And I had students who, which is something more like what I would do, that would say that the commercial points out the ridiculousness of the constructions of masculinity that circulate in our society and how ridiculous it is that we have to have specific ads to get men to drink low calorie sodas. So it matches one ridiculousness with another. So, I mean, I think that there's a lot going on with that ad, and I think it can be read in several ways. Unlike some of the other advertisements that are much more straightforward in their promotion of a specific type of masculinity.
This is Hala, and I'm here with Will Burdett. And Will, do you want to talk a little bit about why you think you are well-suited to talk about food and technology?
Yeah. I'm Will Burdett, and I'm the program coordinator for the Digital Writing and Research Lab. I also make a podcast called No Satiation, and it's about food. And so it's a way to sort of combine my love of food with my love of messing around with new technology.
So can you tell me then, and I know you have some opinions about this, what makes No Satiation special? What makes it different from other food blogs or food podcasts? Because I think it seems like you set out to do something specific, like you had kind of a specific mission in mind. Is that true?
That is true. I had a manifesto, and the manifesto was to find a way to talk about food that wasn't reviews and that wasn't recipes. And I think if you like cut out those two sort of like genres of food writing, that's a lot of the writing about food that we have out there. So if you're not doing reviews and you're not doing recipes, then how do you talk about food?
Right.
And that led me to a sort of food ways approach, which I won't situate myself as a food ways practitioner yet. I think I sort of aspire to that. Mm-hmm. But food ways is pretty, there's methodologies and a discipline and stuff that goes along with that, right? So I don't want to be presumptuous and put myself in that discipline. But at the same time, I think that is ultimately what I aspire to do, sort of like more long form oral history type interviews with people who are doing cool stuff with food.
So is that what you would say Foodways as a discipline is, as kind of more narrative oriented or historically oriented?
Well, my understanding is that oral history is one methodology that Foodways uses to study the sort of cultural and historical significance of food. They have other methodologies as well, but that's one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the one that I think is really well suited to podcasting, because you're already going to be recording, people talking about, their history and food and stuff like that. So why not just edit that into a podcast?
Right. So what would a typical No Satiation episode look like in that case? And how do you get around? To me, it seems like it's really difficult to, when you say reviews, you mean like restaurant reviews?
Yeah. Okay. Restaurant reviews or like product reviews or,
okay.
Things like that.
So what typically, is there a typical episode, and like what would you do or what would you look for topics?
I'm still trying to figure out a typical episode, like what formula works. And right now, what would be ideal for me would be like a short segment about kind of like what's going on locally. I don't always do like news sort of tidbits or whatever, but mm-hmm. sometimes I do. Then a sort of long form interview, which would last about a half hour with somebody who's just doing something interesting food related. Mm-hmm. Most recently I interviewed someone who runs a tortilla factory.
Oh.
Because I'm on this kick right now to talk about the essential ingredients for Tex-Mex, and sort of like break down Tex-Mex into its like component parts. And so I'm looking at like tortillas. So I interviewed an artisan tortilla maker who sells tortillas at Whole Foods.
Mm-hmm.
And then I interviewed a woman who runs, with her husband, a tortilla factory that services like tons of grocery stores and restaurants in the central Texas area.
Huh.
And so, that's one type of interview that I do. That's
so you're interested in like how food is made and how it kind of travels from like an idea to an experience, maybe? Or,
sure.
I don't know. Does that make sense? Like,
yeah. And I'm really not picky right now. This is the same way that I eat too. Like, I'm not picky about who I talk to about food. It's just like, as long as we can have a good conversation, I could be talking with a star chef or mm-hmm. a fellow food writer or podcaster or blogger or someone who makes tortillas or someone who does craft, jams or jellies.
Right.
It doesn't really matter to me, like, where they fall in the food ecosystem, as long as they can have a conversation about food.
Right. So it's less, it sounds like it's less about like, oh, I bought this tomato and it tastes like this, and more about like, and obviously correct me if I'm wrong, but like the social practices around food, maybe?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a perfect way to put it. One of the things that's really challenging about podcasting about food, and this is the same when you, you know, write about food or take videos of food, you're missing most of what makes food food, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you're missing all of the nutrients, you're missing the smell, you're missing the taste. So you're filtering food through this really narrow bandwidth. And if all you do is describe it, it gets really tedious to me. Like, basically at that point, it's just a practice in, like, switching out adjectives.
Right.
You know, of like, this was crunchy, this was salty, this was... You know, and then, like, you can get really clever with your adjectives, right. But, like, you're still just, like...
It's kind of flat.
Yeah, you're just swapping out adjectives. So, like, what I look for is passion. Like, what I look for is emotion. What drives people to continue to do this thing or that thing? And it doesn't have to be even a passion for food. If somebody, you know, slings tacos all day in a food trailer... And what they're really passionate about is, like, putting their kids through college or something, mm-hmm. you know? And this is a means to that end, then I'll talk to them about that, too, right? Like, it doesn't all have to be this sort of, like, gastronomical, you know, conversation. A lot of times, food is just a way to talk to people about what's going on in their lives. You know, it's a sort of common denominator where we can start... with food and then use that as a way to get into, like, you know, whatever is happening with that person at that time.
So I guess, like, you would be the opposite of, like, say, for example, like a wine taster who would be like, this wine has a tobacco-ish and whatever, like these really
nice legs and a full nose,
like,
and
that highly specialized
breadfruit.
Yeah. Like that kind of highly specialized and almost like, I don't want to say ridiculous, but super rarefied kind of vocabulary and practice, right? Because not everybody can be a wine taster.
And right? it's easily parodied, too. And I don't want to talk bad about what, you know, wine folks do. Because, in fact, I'd love to talk to them on the podcast and just break it down. Like, what is this language that you're using? Where did it come from? And I think... probably once you break it down, you find that the language that they use, the words that they use, the sort of grammar and syntax of wine talk is probably trying to do similar things as everybody else who's talking about food. It's like what you're really talking about is people and places and
memories. Yeah.
Absolutely. Traditions and the tension between maintaining traditions and pushing forward. And so, you know, they may have a specialized vocabulary for talking about that, but,
You're interested in the meanings behind that.
Sure.
Right.
And I think to sort of play off of what you were saying before about, the difference between like the way I try to situate my show and the way, someone who talks about wine maybe would produce their show. It's really a matter of ethos, right? Like, my ethos is not that of, like, a wine snob. You know, my ethos is much more a dude in his bedroom trying to figure out, like, how to talk to people about food, you know?
Right.
If, you know, you're not going to talk about reviews and you're not going to talk about recipes, like, what is there left to talk about? Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to figure that out. I don't really have an answer of how to do it wonderfully yet.
I guess, like, the whole idea, like, the title, No Satiation. When you talk about, when people talk about, like, food snobs, right, like wine tasters, so we're going to use that as, like, the scapegoat, like, they spit it out, you know? Like, they don't drink it, you know? And there's a way in which, like, super food snobbery becomes less about experiencing the food and more about... I don't know, like, something else? It becomes less about, like, appetite and more about taste, I guess, or something?
Taste in a very in the way that we're used to talking about taste in the humanities, right?
Right. Like,
not just the sensation of taste or the, you know, the sense of taste, but also
the social
sort of the idea of having good taste, right, or being someone who whose taste is admired or something like that.
Right, like, so locating yourself in a hierarchy of some sort.
Yeah.
Right, whereas, yeah, like, no satiation is about, like, having an appetite and not being satisfied with it. I mean, just eating, I guess, like, as opposed to, like, tasting, you know? I don't know. Maybe I'm reading too much into it.
No, you're not. I've thought a lot about the title when I was trying to come up with what to call the podcast, and really, it's almost like an Eastern kind of thing, where it's like the recognition that you're going to be constantly chasing after this thing, and you're never going to get it.
Right.
So, like, you're never going to get, like, even if you get full, you know, the next day you're going to have to eat again.
Right.
Right. So you're never going to be ultimately satisfied. And so part of it is, like, staying hungry and staying interested in the world and the sort of food ecosystem, but then also, you know, recognizing that that's kind of a never-ending process, I guess.
Right. Okay, so can you tell me then, like, why the podcast genre? I mean, we kind of touched on this a little bit already, but what about the podcast genre or technology in general enables you to better talk about food, and why is it such a popular, I guess, you know, more and more popular thing to do? I mean, why are there so many food blogs, and why do people like to post pictures of their food on the internet? You know, like, with as technology becomes more ubiquitous, it seems like food is a pretty popular subject.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess maybe just start with yourself, because that's a huge question.
No, it is a huge question. And I've thought a little bit about it. You know, there's this sort of paradox of, there's this meme on the internet that, like, nobody cares what you had for lunch, right? Mm-hmm. You know, nobody cares what you had for lunch on Facebook. People even use this meme to sort of, like, disparage whole social networks. Like, I'm not going to join Twitter because I don't care what you had for lunch.
Right.
And at the same time, like, clearly lots of people really care what you're eating for lunch, right? Like,
I mean, they're interested, yeah.
Yeah, like individuals care, corporations care, the government cares. Okay. You know, there's a lot of investment in what we're eating. And so this meme of, like, nobody cares what you eat, alongside the fact that, like, clearly lots of people have vested interests in what you eat, I think says something. And I think one of the things that meme says is, it's like it's an emotional sort of response to a deluge of food imagery or whatever. It's like basically people saying, like, I've had enough, you know, like, mm-hmm, I've seen enough. And I liken it to, like, baby pictures on Facebook, right? Like,
right,
I've seen enough baby pictures on, yeah, Facebook.
They all look the same.
They all look the same. Like, I don't need to see any more. I've seen enough pictures of your birthday, you know, dinner or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, and so I think, you know, there is this really funny moment that we're in right now where people keep doing that. People keep posting pictures of their food to social networks, even as their audience is saying, like, we've had enough. And then at the same time, sometimes they find a smaller, more focused, I guess, audience that actually is like, yeah, keep them coming, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so for me and, like, food, like, I didn't know that anybody cared until I plugged into the networks that actually do care. So, like, as soon as I got into the Austin Food Blogger Alliance, Foodways Texas, some of the other food communities that have a really big online presence, and started to see that, wow, people actually do care,
mm-hmm,
then it started to make a difference. So when you ask, like, why is podcasting popular or becoming more popular, why would people food podcast or food blog or you know, stuff like that, I think one of the reasons is just to sort of find that community,
mm,
right? So, like, it's just a I mean, I think it's just like any other sort of like hobby or endeavor. Like, you're doing it to find other people who are like-minded who are also doing it.
Right.
And ultimately, it just becomes a way to connect with people.
From Contigo Restaurant. Can you briefly describe Contigo?
It's an outdoor, mostly outdoor restaurant in East Austin. It was intended to be a neighborhood restaurant, cozy, comfortable.
Was it always going to be Contigo? That was always the name?
That was always the name, yeah.
Okay, and what does Contigo mean to you guys?
It translates to with you.
When you first were conceptualizing this restaurant, did you start off with the food? Did you start off with the location, the feel? What was, you know, kind of your first instinct?
So my business partner, Ben, owns a ranch called Contigo Ranch, and he wanted to create Contigo Restaurant. So if and when you go to Contigo Ranch, that's where Ben's parents live, and they built this big house. It's a hunting ranch, so they sell X number of hunts a year during whitetail season, and they have people come down and they host them, and they show them a great time. They put them on world-class deer, and the living quarters and how you're taken care of is what we're trying to live up to. It's directly related to the experience at Contigo Ranch. And the idea behind it is you can't take everybody to the ranch, so we wanted to bring that feel here. Not in that kitschy dude ranch kind of way by any means, but just like just comfortable, good people.
Where would you draw the line between that kitschy dude ranch, you know, look, and then what you have here, which is, you know, like you said, more connected to the actual Contigo Ranch? Like, what are some specific features here that you think successfully capture Contigo?
Lots of wood and metal, iron, raw iron, these tables being welded and kind of unfinished, but still tight edges.
Yeah.
Not the natural edge. Serving food in cast irons, out of pie tins.
Yeah.
Well thought out food served in a very casual way. When we go to eat, we like to go with our friends and order a lot of food and share things. So that's how we design the menu. Service is something that I realized a while back makes or breaks an experience. Especially when you go and you dine in the upper echelons of restaurants in the country or in the world, talking best restaurants in the world. It seems like you hit a ceiling of how good the food can be. It can be different, but you go to the French Laundry or to Persay or to Corton or Alinea, and you have just the best food you've ever tasted. It doesn't get any better. But what sets those experiences apart from each other are the rest of your experience for the night, and that's the service, and that's the attitude of the people that are taking care of you. We were both very inexperienced on owning a business, building a restaurant, running a restaurant. Looking back, had we had experience, we probably would have done things a lot differently. But I'm glad we did it the way we did it, because it's worked so far. We were kind of selfish in the way that we designed a lot of the things. We both grew up just some form of ranching as a hobby or a means of income, or we both like sitting outside and playing the guitar and spitting and telling lies and hanging out with our friends. So that was a big reason on why we designed a place like this.
So when you opened up the restaurant, what did you do for advertisement? Did you use the internet? Did you use newspapers? Was it word of mouth? What was your strategy?
Social media was a major part of it. And we also hired a PR company that plugged us into their existing links.
And what type of social media?
Twitter, Facebook. We've got our Contigo account, and then I've got my own account. And even more so than getting the word out about Contigo with stuff, I find it as a good way to connect with people around the world that are in my same business. Sharing links and sharing ideas for a dish or an ingredient or making vinegar or recently, well, I guess at the beginning of the year, a friend of mine that owns Foreign and Domestic hosted something that he called Indie Chefs Week. And it was 4 days, Wednesday through Saturday. And it was Wednesday, it was 8 chefs from Austin. Thursday was 8 chefs from the East Coast. Friday was 8 chefs from West Coast. And Saturday was a collaboration of everybody. So it was 8 chefs, 8 courses the first 3 nights. And the last night was 24 chefs, 24 courses. The majority of the people that were invited from East Coast and West Coast met on Twitter.
Okay.
And you just see common interest in what people are doing. Fellow nerds, you know. That was an awesome experience because I met a lot of new people, and I kind of realized the power of Twitter specifically, but social media beyond your business, I guess.
So is it more pictures that you're posting on Twitter?
Yeah.
And is it mostly stuff that you're making in Contigo, or is it also?
No, it would be typically food related things, or if I go eat somewhere, or I see something out that is related to my work, then I'll take a picture of it and put it on. Because I see the value in it, I want to get more into it.
You say see the value in it. What do you define that value to be? What is the value in it?
Building relationships, making and creating new relationships. You can kind of see different networks of people, whether it's people from New York that work in New York, and you can kind of see where people have gone from there. I'm headed to Scandinavia to do a 2-week stage in a kitchen there, and so I've started like picking up people around there, and you can kind of see who their disciples are that have come. Like one guy's now in Houston with a really badass restaurant, and you got another guy out on this island who owns a restaurant called the Willows off of Seattle or Washington, I guess. And you kind of just see where people have gone, and it's a good way to follow like the upper echelon of what I'm doing and where I want to be or where I want to get to.
How did you decide on what you were going to serve Contigo? How does the menu look, and what decisions went into making it?
I base it a lot on what's available. We get a lot of produce from different farms around here, and our meat all comes from different farms. And it kind of, as much as I really believe that that's a good thing to do, it also just kind of makes it easier for me because it gives me a starting point of this is what we have available. All right, so I've got this stuff. What can I do with this stuff? As opposed to it being even more broad, and I can get anything I want from anywhere I want, and it's like, well, all right, well, where do I start? So it's, while it's a good thing to be doing, it's also a very helpful thing to be doing. It's also, other than our ground beef and our beef tongues, we only get whole animals.
Okay.
So we get about 60 chickens a week. We get them twice a week. We get rabbits, 12 to 30 a week, delivered a couple times a week, and we get a whole pig every week. And we've got certain items that haven't changed, and they go directly, pieces of these animals go directly to that. But then we've got the skin from the chicken and the skin from the pig. We've got each bird comes with 2 wings and 2 legs. And we sell the wings. We prepare the wings in a certain way and sell them forward to an order. Well, when we're out, we're out. We aren't supplementing with things. So the menu is definitely affected by what each animal yields. So we print menus every day, and we've got a real small freezer in there. So we'll cryovac chicken wings from these 30 birds and these 30 birds, and then the following week we'll pull them out of the freezer, comfy them, cure them and comfy them, do what we do to them, and then run chicken wings for 2 days or 3 days or 4 days or until they're gone. And the legs, we each day we put them, that they come in, Wednesday they come in. Wednesdays and Saturdays our chickens come in. Saturday we put the legs in buttermilk with our seasonings, and then Wednesday we do the same thing, and then Thursday we sell $1 chicken legs, fried chicken legs, and when they're gone, they're gone. There's not a whole lot else. We did some other things with them, but there's a lot of tendons in them, and it's turned into a good thing to do. We don't make any money. We actually lose a little money on them, but we get people in that want $1 fried chicken, and they order 25 long stars. As far as how each dish is worded, it's just how I decided I want to word it. And then we'll let it ride worded a certain way for a few days. And if it's a good dish but it's not selling, we'll switch it up a little bit. And it's how it's worded is a big, carries big weight on how it sells.
How do you communicate to your guests this importance and this, you know, fresh meat, fresh food, and the way that you do business? How do you communicate it on the menu? How do you communicate it outside the menu?
Very subliminally. We never have said local as a selling word. Farm to table is not a word we use. They just seem so trendy right now, and they're misused a lot of times, and people are starting to realize that. And they hear those things, and they immediately start questioning it. We're just wanting to create a good experience and serve fresh, quality bar food is how we describe our food. That's the phrase that we came up with because we had to have something to tell people. What kind of food are you serving? And that's what we came up with in the beginning, was fresh quality bar food. We buy fresh food, we look for quality, and we start from as close by as we can, and we work our way out.
That's all for this week's episode of Zoogma, which was produced by Andrew Usendowski. Special thanks to all our guest interviewees. This is also a wrap on our podcast's first season, so thanks to all the members of the Zoogma team. Axel Bowman, Lisa Gulasarian, Paula Herbley, Michael Roberts, Patrick Schultz, and Andrew Usendowski. And thanks to you, our listeners, for supporting this podcast. You can check out all our first season episodes on our website, zoogma.dwrl.utexas.edu, or on our Liberated Syndication profile, dwrlpodcast.libsyn.com. We're also downloadable via the iTunes Store. Check out our Facebook page and look us up on Twitter for more information and updates. This is Eric Detweiler, signing off for the first season of Zoogma, the Rhetoric and Technology podcast for the University of Texas at Austin's Digital Writing and Research Lab.